FIU.
NBR John and FIU George. Okay. GXM. I think it's Kilo Delta 2 GXM. Start off with your name, sir, and your favorite rig that you recommend. Mr. GXM, you got it.
Thank you, Dick. This is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray, Mike Rich. I actually have two suggestions. My favorite rig, vintage, is the ICOM IC751A. I love the 751A. More modern brand new could be the Yasu or Yaesu FT991A. The FT991A gives you all bands from 80 through 2 meters. I think it gives you 80 through 440, in fact. And you could investigate those. K2RIW in the group, WD2GXM.
Put me in there, Dick, and Tobia.
You hear me, Thomas? Okay, Rich, you're in there. Let's see now. Rich, GXM. Your suggestions were the IC751A and the Yaesu FT991A. Very rough guess. How many dollars are each of those in medium good condition on the used market? Mr. GXM, K2RIW.
IC751A, I would guess you'd pay about $300 for it for a very good condition. The FT991A is still brand new, and that goes for roughly $1,100
to $1,200. WB2GXM. KD2, HUC with a comment.
HUC, you're on the list. Okay. Next person with a comment was N2NBR. John, go right ahead with your favorite rig that you're recommending. You got it, John?
Okay, Dick. The handle here is John in the QTH in Northern Westchester, and I'm currently running an ICOM 756 Pro 3. I bought that about 4 years ago. I can't tell you what it's worth now, but before that I had an old ICOM 745. Both rigs are running fine. And speaking of antennas that we talked about before, the antenna that I'm using currently on that one, the low band antenna, is a Cobra Ultralight. You can get it in 160 through 10 or 80 through 10. 160 is 200 feet. You can get it in 140 foot range, and the 80 through 10 is 73 feet. So it depends on how much room you have there, but that's all I can offer you right now. I'm sorry I haven't looked up to any values lately.
Thank you, John. Some more good suggestions. ICOM 756 Crow 3, and I can't read my writing. I think it was 745 is the other one that you used and liked an awful lot. And you like that Culber Ultralight antenna, which looks like it covers almost everything. Thank you, John. Rich N2EO, you got a suggestion as to what was your favorite rig in the past. You're a Collins man from way back, but I don't think you're going to recommend Collins. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
K2FIU.
You're on the list, George. Don't worry.
Okay, Dick. N2EO. Well, I'm on both sides of the fence. I'm very skilled. I used to buy all used stuff and fix it up and actually make it like brand new by respraying it and getting cosmetic parts. I made it look like new and work like new, and we keep get them. The problem is, if you're not skilled, or you can't fix them up, that's a problem. Like now I'm on the other side of the fence. I'm disabled, I can't see well, and my hands shake. So I have to go with the new. So it depends whether the gentleman is skilled enough to fix it. Remember, you and I are both techs. If he's not good at doing this, it takes a lot of skills, you know, and takes years. I recommend no.
I'm not in complete agreement on that. Once a person develops the attitude that he's willing to open up the case, and violate the warranty. That's a joke. Almost no rig do you violate the warranty just because you've opened up the case, as long as you use some reasonable safety procedures. For an amateur to do his own troubleshooting with the assistance of his friends, and particularly on a club like this one, where you've got some very skilled people like the B2CDL and KE2EJ and whatever, you've got guys that can fix anything. So even if you get yourself in trouble, you go hat in hand and you go to talk to these guys and say, can you fix it? I did something wrong. So repairing a rig because it's used, and the fact that somebody used a piece of equipment doesn't mean he's worn it out. Sometimes a used piece of equipment that's got a dented front panel because it's been bounced down a flight of stairs, you can get it at a very good price, and sometimes it'll work extremely well. Okay, we've got both George and Steve and other people on the list. George next. KD2FIU, K2IW, what's your favorite rig, and what do you suggest, new or used, George? You got it, George.
Dick, clarification here. I thought we were trying to help the other operator. I didn't write down his call. I'm sorry. I thought we're trying to help him with a first HF rig, 10 through 80. Clarification, please.
Those are the suggestions we've been giving him. Go right ahead, George. And by the way, him is Rich. Okay, I can't have trouble reading my own writing. GXM. WB2GXM. He's the guy we're making suggestions for right now. You got it, George.
Well, I'll say this, that some of the radios are very complex to fix. If you want an introduction into HF, and I started with this myself, and I know a lot of people who have started with this, it's an ICOM 718, an IC718. Rock solid, stable HF rig. Get it brand new, maybe $600, $650. It will sell 2 years later for $500, $550. Excellent, rock solid, stable rig. Other rigs we've spoken about in the past, yes, they're good. Well, you could take a 775 DSP ICOM, top of the hill in 1999. Guess what? The same 32-bit floating DSP, triple heterodyne floating IF DSP system was in the IC7000 if you wanted to press a few more buttons. If we're going to go back, go back solid, go back big, but be ready to prepare. If you want to open up with HF, ICOM, IC718, and I say stay away from the Yaesu 450D, it's a softbox compared to this. The IC718 is a real HF radio. KD2FIU.
I know some people who love that 450 even though you don't like it. Okay. 718 sounds like another good suggestion. As you can tell, Rich, we're slowly getting to the point where the total number of choices you've got is becoming very large, and your search is probably going to be more of you going into eBay and find out what's available today, so to speak, as opposed to looking for a specific rig. And once you find out what's available, then you recheck with your friends saying that what's the track record for that particular rig. Okay, Steve is the next person who's going to give us some suggestions. KD2HUC, what's your favorite used and or new rig that you would suggest for a person buying his first one, Steve? K2LIW.
Well, Dick, I have to agree with this. My first rig was the Yaesu FT991. They've since come out with the 991A, but as far as bang for the buck, you can't go wrong. It's all mode, almost all band. It's $1,200-$1,300, and it's a lot of radio for the dollar. And then if you want to get your hands dirty playing around with used equipment, everybody knows, as soon as you go on HF and, you know, you're trying to work a pile up, you're going to be looking for an afterburner. So that's something you can play with, you know, putting back together, you get used equipment, but at least you get something new, getting on the air right away, so you, you know, you learn your way around. Just my opinion. KD2HUC, back to now.
JXM.
Steve, your audio is extremely hot. So hot that you were putting out square waves into the audio, if you know what I mean. And so some of the words were a little bit difficult to interpret. GXM, go right ahead with your information. K2RIW.
Sorry, Dick. This is Rich, Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. I'm not the Rich that's asking. You got the wrong Rich. I got to get myself a different name. GXM.
Okay. We're still forming a rig for, then I guess it was Ken? Yes. Ken, was it you that's asking for a suggestion as to which rig to buy? Sorry, I created a confusion. KD2QBC, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is Ken asking for recommendations. KD2QBC.
Now, I'm going to turn it back to Steve. Steve, we had trouble copying an awful lot of what you said because the audio was so hot. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
I think, is this any better?
You've come down 8 dB and you're getting into the right ballpark. Still a tiny bit hot. Go ahead.
Alright. My little guy happened to turn my mic gain all the way up. Must have been playing around. Anyway, no, I had said that for, I agree with the other Rich that the FT991, which is what I own, or the FT991A, which is the second version, you can't go wrong with that radio. It's about $1,300. It's all mode, pretty much all band. It goes all the way up to 440, and it's a lot of radio for the money. If, you know, you get your feet wet with that, you buy that, you can get on the air and learn your way around. And then if you want to play with used equipment, you pick yourself up a nice used afterburner and you can put it back together, and it's, you know, relatively easy to break yourself into doing repairs with that. Just my opinion. KD2HUC, back to net.
And I think there was one other person that was going to make suggestions as to what Ken should be using. That other person, if you're still there, please give me a call. That is a name. K2RIW. Okay. As you can tell, Ken, the total number of choices you've got is quite large. When it comes to used equipment that has a good track record, that people know and love, used it for lots of years, didn't have too much trouble, not too easy not too difficult to repair and so on, not too expensive. As you can tell, there's a large number of choices, and maybe you didn't have a chance to write them all down. Don't worry. You can play this whole soliloquy, you can play it all back by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and this technet you're hearing tonight, all of it will be recorded, and you can play it back there about 6 days from now, and then from then on. The last 11 years of TechNet are all recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play it all back. And therefore, you can take your own sweet time listening to those reels of audio and writing down all of these suggested numbers. And you're allowed to come back next week and ask the question again. So, as you can tell, once you leave the idea of saying, I've got to have a brand new shiny piece of equipment that no one else has ever used, and you're willing to use used equipment, you can save a lot of money. The total number of choices becomes very large. And it's on. Let me drop this. Because the number of choices is so large, the situation flips around. Instead of choosing a rig and trying to find that rig, you'll find out during the next month what's available on the used equipment sites. And there's lots of used equipment sites. And once you find something that sounds good and you come back and recheck with us as to whether or not you should buy that particular one, you'll get an answer. So you're allowed to ask this question again. I know it's rather difficult buying your very first rig, and you think it's a difficult choice. Once you do it, you'll find out it's nowhere near as bad as you think. The total number of lemons out there is very few. I've bought an awful lot of used test equipment in my last 50 years of ham radio. Only once did I buy a lemon. and that particular lemon happened to be an ICOM 450 megacycle rig, where the mistake that was made is they forgot to wash off all of the flow solder rosin from the board, and that very active solder was eating into all the integrated circuit chips and eating into all the air variable capacitors, and therefore the rig had a lot of intermittence. Of all the used equipment I bought after all of these years, I've only had one lemon, and you've now got access to people who know how to fix almost anything. Back to you for any further questions or fills, and you're allowed to ask this question again next week if you want to. KD2QBC, K2RIW. Sorry, I switched you up, but with some other people can.
Oh, that's not a problem. I think I got most of them written down. I do appreciate the recommendations, and I guess that'll be it for me. KD2QBC, thank you.
Okay, sounds like Rich has a further comment. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, well, I get concerned when somebody's a newbie wants to buy a first radio to somebody who's a cook.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Ham radio outlet, HRO, I understand now, sells used. They're taking trades. They would be probably the best place to go.
Okay, I thank you, Rich. So, of all the zillions of used equipment places, that's the one that you recommend. Sounds good. We're going to go to the next section now of the TechNet, which is the physics and science section, run by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy, go right ahead with your presentation tonight. AC2GS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Dick. This is Science Talk. Just as a tail end of the previous discussion, I kind of like new equipment in the 7300s or one of those radios that every third guy on the HF band seems to own, and they're very happy with it, and it's not terribly expensive, so put that list of all the other models to consider. Anyway, this is Science Talk. Once again, the email address to contact me to either ask for a topic, ask a question, or make a suggestion of a presentation is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I have a website that has links. It is roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. What I do on the web page is I put links to the articles that I talk about and further source materials, so that if it's of interest to you, you can click it and read the articles and go from there. In addition, this week I've put up a couple of initial links already. One is a YouTube that's a very nice video demonstration of fluid dynamics and vortex collisions. They make these wonderful vortexes using food dyes, red and green, and they shoot at each other in water, and you see the fluid dynamics like a ballet. So I have a link there. If anyone's interested, they can press the link and see the pretty pictures. Let me drop. In addition, as long as I was giving one YouTube link, I also added a second YouTube link. Sometimes people listen to other guys talking about Maxwell's equation, and sometimes they even talk about these vector operations called curls and divergences, and most people, including engineers, sometimes, unfortunately, don't really know what those are. A link to a very nice illustration of the concepts of those vector operations for anyone curious and so inclined. It's relatively light on Max. It's just pretty pictures, so that's another link. Also, I'm reading a new book on the biography of Max Planck, Driven by Vision, Broken by War, and it's a very interesting one. He was a very brilliant man and complex, as most brilliant people are, and it's a very good read if anyone's interested. I have a link for that. Let me drop. Okay, the game plan for tonight is, once again, I will go through some interesting articles that I've seen in the last week that relate to different aspects of science. I selected from all kinds of different fields, just so it isn't the same old stuff over and over again. It's, I think, not too complicated. And I will pause between each little article to give anyone an opportunity to either ask questions or make comments or to ask about things that don't quite make sense. So don't worry that you'll interrupt me. I'll keep a good eye on the list, and I won't where I was. So once again, when I go through one of the articles, I'll drop for possible comments, and that's your cue if you're interested to hit that push talk button and ask me a question or make a comment. Let me drop. Okay, no. A common theme of experiments is attempting to find the boundaries where the theory of general relativity tends to fall apart. In its 100-plus year history, many experiments undreamt of when it was first proposed have been carried out, and general relativity has yet to be disproven. Why does science keep looking for chinks in its armor? Well, for one, that is what science always does. It never takes any idea as sacrosanct and unchallengeable. Science has learned its lesson of depending upon wisdom of past giants to be the last voice concerning how all these fantastic things work. Equally important is that science really wants to find an answer to so-called dark matter, the proposed matter that seems to be keeping galaxies from flying apart at rotational velocities that they appear to be spinning at. While others search for the elusive theoretical weakly interacting mass of particles, or WIMPs, or other dark matter candidates such as axions, black holes, superfluids, and more, another approach entirely is that we just have gotten gravity all wrong. And the best way for some of them to find proof of that is to document failures in general relativity in extreme cases out there among the stars. Let me drop. General relativity in space usually involves measuring how much an object bends the fabric of space itself to determine its mass. This recent experiment tried the exact opposite, using an already calculated mass to see whether the predictions of general relativity hold up. That mass can warp the space of the shape of space itself is a fundamental part of general relativity. Scientists have observed it repeatedly by looking at how heavy objects in space, like clusters of galaxies, warp the light passing around them. Scientists first spotted this during the 1919 solar eclipse, during which the blacked-out sun appeared to have slightly shifted the position of background stars. Before Einstein completed his theory of general relativity, an attempt was made to prove this nascent theory during the eclipse of August 21, 1914, but the Great War got in the way, and the experiment was delayed until peace broke out. It's probably a lucky thing that this happened, because between 1914 and the final version of general relativity, Albert Einstein corrected a few small math errors in his earlier version of his theory of general relativity. The errors would have caused the difference between his calculated results and the experimental results, so it's a good thing that he had to kind of delay things. Let me drop. Scientists continue to spot this phenomenon today, and now know that heavy foregone objects can warp light so much that background stars and galaxies appear like a ring in the sky. For those interested in how gravitational lensing works, rather than producing a focal point, as seen with optical lenses, it produces something called the focal line that causes points of light to appear as ring-light sources. The researchers used one of these Einstein rings to perform their experiment. They calculated the mass of the foreground galaxy, one called ESO-325-G004, by measuring how its stars moved. Then they calculated the curvature of the Einstein ring surrounding the galaxy to determine how much it deforms the surrounding space. The property to describe mass curving effect is called gamma, and the theory predicts that it should be equal to 1. The scientists calculated it at 0.97, give or take 0.09 for potential sources of uncertainty, according to the papers published in Science. In other words, their observation agreed with the theory quite well. This proved that the way mass warps space-time is exactly correct, that the fundamental properties of general relativity and how space-time behaves was proven again. But don't worry that these physicists are now out of a job. Just because they prove general relativity in one galaxy doesn't necessarily within all galaxies. So these people will probably pick another galaxy and have another go at it. Let's hope them a, relatively speaking, boring time. Let me drop for possible comments.
K2RW, some comments?
Yes, Dick.
I wanted to see if there's anyone else who want to make a comment. As you know, a galaxy was discovered recently that seems to have no dark matter. And the majority of galaxies seem to have an awful lot of dark matter, meaning that you visually see a bunch of stars, and you think the visual response tells you how many stars are there and how much mass there is, and yet you look at the rotation of the galaxy, and you find out it rotates much too fast, particularly out at the perimeter. So there's hidden mass somewhere in there that's not showing up as light. Okay, that's fact number one. Fact number two, let me drop. We slowly zeroed in on the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy, Milky Way. And I think the best belief right now is it has 4 million solar masses, the main black hole at the center of our galaxy. And you can estimate that by watching a bunch of other stars circling around it at the center, at the nucleus of our galaxy, and looking at how fast they move. Some of the recent estimates are that there are 20 black holes in the center of our galaxy, and there is one other estimate that could be 10,000. There's a slim possibility, and by the time the Great Big Telescope that's about to be issued in a couple of years, yeah, James Webb, I keep forgetting, the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to look through the dust and really find out how many black holes are there, because they emit energy that the an infrared telescope can see. There are estimates that could be as many as 10,000 black holes, smaller than the 4 million solar masses, in our nucleus of our galaxy. And since black holes in general, as long as they're not eating a whole lot of local material, let me drop. As long as they're not eating a lot of material, black holes are quiet. They don't emit any energy, per se. If they're eating a whole lot of material, then you see a whole lot of X-rays as stuff goes through their event horizon. So if we could have as many as 10,000 smaller black holes in the center nucleus of our galaxy and some distribution of them throughout our galaxy, I see the possibility that these non-emitting, non-eating black holes distributed in galaxies could be one of the major sources of the missing material called dark matter. I wonder if we've read any articles that suggest that so far. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick. I mean, there's a lot of candidates for the so-called dark matter. There are little strange theoretical things called axions. There is theories that there are black holes involved. There are superfluid theories, and about every week there's another interesting theory. The problem is you can't just use the black holes that are in the center of our galaxy. You need to distribute them more diffusely in order for the spins to sort of work out. But still, there's a theory, there are theories that involve black holes being scattered across the entirety of galaxies causing the effect. Going back to that story about the galaxy that had no dark matter, there's apparently a lot of contention on that. There's a lot of physicists arguing about the interpretation of the results. So, you know, the last bet isn't in quite on that. So it might not be so. But there's lots of theories, but unfortunately very little in the way of facts.
C2LR.
Okay, what would you like to say?
I have permission to ask a question that's kind of a tangent to this.
Sure, Kay, ask away.
I read today that we believe the globular clusters that we see through our telescopes, in the, you know, amateur telescopes in the night sky, they're believing they're about 13 billion years old. And I tried to look up how we know that. How are we measuring their age? and I couldn't find anything. Do you know, or does anyone know, how are we measuring the age of these globular clusters that are supposedly right around the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, so they're not that far away, but they're, you know, relatively speaking, they're not that far away, that they're that old? Back to NET. This is AC2LR.
Okay. Interesting question. I don't know what has given them that idea. Perhaps the constituent spectrographic results denote something that's kind of very late in its age, but I haven't read that article, so I'm not quite sure. If anyone else has any ideas, feel free. Okay, Kay, I'm afraid, big question mark. I'll have to do some reading and try and figure it out. I am not really aware of that much that's nearby us that's particularly old. This is a novelty, but I'll take a look at it, and if I figure something out, I'll mention it next week.
Thank you. AC2LR.
And I'm going to add a couple words, Roy. In the case of the supermassive black hole, four million solar masses at the center of our galaxy, and we're watching a number of other stars move around it very rapidly with, you know, periods of rotation in a small number of years, so it's easy to track them, and therefore you can track the mass. And therefore, looking at the wiggles of those things that are moving around, you can find out how many other black holes are there. So we can easily recognize multiple black holes in the center of our galaxy. There probably are black holes distributed throughout our galaxy, but since you have no local motion of objects nearby with long enough periods that we can short enough periods that we can easily measure, confirming the presence of non-emitting black holes that are distributed throughout our galaxy is very difficult. Just because we have trouble measuring them doesn't mean they're there. The evidences are that something there with a lot of mass and black holes are, as I see it, a significant candidate. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I agree with you, Dick. It's one of the theories. The problem that I tend to have is why, you know, most things kind of inevitably get drawn gravitationally to the center of large collections of matter. And yet these black holes seem to be indifferent and just hang out diffusely. So I'm a little concerned if that's black holes, exactly why their distribution seems to be the way it is. Because, you know, if you look at matter in the entire galaxy, it's all been kind of scrunched down to a single plane with an angular momentum, and you'd sort of expect the black holes, although not radiating, to kind of fit into the same type of configuration, which they don't. They seem to be this diffuse cloud of mass hanging over all the galaxies that we measure, except for that one where it's up to dispute.
Okay, you have a feeling that an awful lot of things that are in our galaxy are going to eventually migrate to the center. I don't see it that way. As I see it, the center of the galaxy, for a whole bunch of reasons, has a whole lot of mass. As such, a whole lot of stars form there. As such, a whole lot of stars are merging there, probably making gravitational wave things that can be detected at some later time. So a lot of merged stars in the center of our galaxy give you a lot of concentration of black holes there. It doesn't mean that all the black holes there have migrated. An awful lot of the stars out at the perimeter in the arms of our galaxy, with a mixture of those black holes, they don't necessarily have to migrate to the center. They can stay right where they are, taking 250 million years to make a complete revolution around our galaxy. And if they are migrating to the center, they're going to take tens of trillions of years, tens of billions of years to do it. And so I see the possibility of a distribution of black holes as well as other kinds of stars out in the arms that don't have to migrate. But because the black holes are not now eating something, they're not giving any evidence that they're there, but certainly their gravity is there. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Okay, I mean, it is possible. We don't have any evidence for it. No other star has gotten close enough to them to be swallowed in and produce the incredible energy discharge from the accretion disk being eaten up by it, which is probably a good thing because that's probably somewhat dangerous depending upon where it is in relation to us. So it's still one of the many theories, but again, I think it's theory because it too has yet to be proven, although I would feel better that something as simple as a black hole would be the answer, not theoretical particles that we don't even know exist.
There's one other bit of confusion going on here. Let me drop it. When we take a photograph of a galaxy, like say for instance the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 2 million light years away from us, and it has a diameter of something like a quarter or a half a million light years diameter. You take a photograph of this huge thing. All of those 100 billion to 200 billion stars that are in that galaxy, in that photograph, look very dense. They are not. They are very sparse. The closest star to us, Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away. Maybe the average spacing between stars in our galaxy is, let me pick a number, 10 light years. That might be the average spacing. Two separate galaxies can collide with each other. You think it's a collision. The spacing between the stars is so great that all of those stars of those two separate galaxies fold through each other with almost no collisions. They sense the gravity of each other, and that creates scattering, and it makes a funny-looking spirals and whatever. But the spacing between stars is so great that two galaxies can fold to each other with almost no impacts. With that greater spacing, if some of those things with that spacing are black holes that are not revolving around something else, detecting them is very difficult, even though they could very well be there. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Again, I agree with you, Dick. The present theory, at least that I've heard, is when we inevitably collide with Andromeda, the resulting mishmash is going to be more like an elliptical galaxy than both of our spirals. But those are due to, again, gravitational forces, not collisions. 99.99999% of a galaxy, just like any, you know, talking about matter and such, is empty space. So, yeah, I agree with you on all these factors, but you know, a lack of evidence doesn't prove evidence. So it's on the list of possibilities, and once again, I prefer it much more to black holes that I'm aware of and there's theories about than weakly interacting massive particles, which someone just pulled out of their supersymmetry theory. That poor Hadron Collider keeps on trying to find and fails miserably at it. Anyone with any other further comments on this subject? Okay. An excavation of a million people's genes have provided us with some interesting clues on how several common psychiatric disorders might arise, including major depression and schizophrenia. It's also highlighted connections between some mental illnesses and other health problems, including heart disease. An international group of researchers from the United States, the United Kingdom, China, Singapore, Japan, Australia collaborated for a project dubbed the Brainstorm Study. They pulled together genetic data from 265,000 patients diagnosed with one of 25 different brain disorders and compared them to genetic data of 785 people with no such diagnosis. Most of the disorders included were conditions thought to be psychiatric in nature, but they also included neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's disease and multiple sclerosis, as well as migraines, epilepsy, and stroke. Let me drop. People with different neurological disorders did not have significant genetic patterns in common with one another or with people who had psychiatric illnesses. But the same wasn't true of people with psychiatric illnesses. In particular, people who either had anorexia nervosa or obsessive compulsive disorder or schizophrenia had the most genetic overlap with one another. And people with schizophrenia tended to share a lot in common genetically with people who had other mental illnesses, such as depression. People with depression also had many similar genetic patterns with those who had bipolar disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Let me drop. The study, published in Science, was the largest of its kind, according to its authors. A person's genetics are, of course, only a small part of why they might develop a mental illness. And an individual genetic variation linked to mental illnesses amounts to a tiny drop in a bucket when it comes to risk. But by looking at many of the risk-associated genes as possible at the same time, the researchers say we can better understand how and why mental illness happens in the first place. The findings here suggest, as other recent studies have, that there is no clear border between certain mental illnesses. Many of the same genes that make your brain vulnerable to depression also make it susceptible to schizophrenia, for example. These genes and other factors, like our environment, could affect how the brain functions in more than one way, accounting for the different manifestations of mental illness. Let me drop. But many psychiatric disorders could still share some common traits caused by similar dysfunctions in the brain, such as the lack of concentration seen in both people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and schizophrenia. The research also suggests a person's brain can be harmed through means and cause similar symptoms, such as the psychosis seen in people with late-stage Alzheimer's and schizophrenia. The tradition of drawing these sharp lines when patients are diagnosed probably doesn't follow the reality, where mechanisms in the brain might be causing overlapping symptoms. The study also reaffirms some previous research looking at connections between our physical and mental well-being. Let me drop. People who had strokes or heart disease were more likely to have genes associated with major depression, for instance. And people with higher attained education levels or reported intelligence had a greater genetic risk for several disorders, such as anorexia nervosa, autism spectrum disorder, and bipolar disorder. A lower attained education level was associated with a greater risk of attention deficit disorder, depression, and anxiety. These results suggest the existence of a link between cognitive performance in early life and the genetic risk for both psychiatric and neurological brain disorders. The connection between a person's educational level and certain brain disorders they might share may be related to common genetic origins, but it might also reflect that early potentially changeable life factors can have long-lasting effects on mental and neurological health. Let me drop.
Make a comment, Roy, and
second, I'll be done soon, and you can anyone can make a comment. People who do poorly at school, for instance, have been shown to be more likely to develop Alzheimer's, while higher education seems to have a preventive effect. The researchers state that they plan to keep studying these questions, hopefully by using even larger data sets of people's genes. Let me drop for possible comments.
I'm picking up, boy.
That was your cue.
Okay, boy, and we are, you struck a chord. Because, you know, I have Tourette syndrome, and that's linked a lot of times, and I have it, bipolar disorder. Attention deficit disorder. I had all those problems. So it helped, it kept me from being able to work. So, what can I say? But I had that problem, those problems from a child. They just didn't recognize at that time.
Hopefully, psychiatrists, psychologists, and pediatricians are much more likely to look into cognitive development in children than they did when you were a young child. I mean, I don't think I recall autistic syndrome being even discussed before I was 30, 40 years old. So, you know, the field is developing. Some of it is genetics. Some of it is environment. I can't do much about the genetics for the time being. But hopefully things can be done about the environment. So what can I tell you? Rich, some people are luckier than other people.
Okay, boy. Well, I know my parents had it too. My father had OCD and a little bit of Tourette's. My mother was hyperactive and, what was it now? You know, when I first found out what I had, Tourette's goes way back, but the depression wasn't really recognized until, I guess, in the 80s or whatever. And the first medication, you probably remember, Prozac, came on the market, was a godsend to me. Now I take something called, I forget.
Well, Rich, I don't like to kind of diagnose and treat and give recommendations over a radio, because that's not really how medicine works, but bipolar disorder, depressions are very common in the population, unfortunately. I don't know if anyone's been reading, but the suicide rates, unfortunately, seem to be climbing up, which is really bad. And it's very sad. I think I mentioned that I was reading about Max Planck, a brilliant man, who apparently didn't really suffer himself, but everyone around him seemed to suffer from severe depressive disorders, and he had a granddaughter who committed suicide, and it was a mess. So it afflicts every family in one way or another.
Oh, I understand. Boy, I'm telling you, I'm not asking you for a diagnosis over the radio. I wanted to give everybody a little benefit of my knowledge. I learned a lot about my disorders because I had to. And to you.
Okay, Rich. As in most things on this path, I would suggest seeking professional help. They're trained and used to dealing with these problems. They know the medications and treatments available. They know the research going on, and that's where professionals shine. You don't want to be your own professional. It's the old adage of a man who's his own lawyer has a fool for a client.
I'm just telling you because I want people to know what I've benefited from knowing about myself. I do have professionals. I have a social worker comes in regularly, and other professionals, doctor, you name it, doctor, lawyer, and chief, okay. And the medication of remembering or forgetting. Cymbalta. That's what I take now. Cymbalta.
Okay, Rich. You know, there's no such thing as a panacea. What works best for one person doesn't necessarily work as well for everyone. Fortunately, there's a lot of medication out there, and they're doing research for more. Gone are the strange old days of Freudian psychoanalysis, where everything had to do with your toilet training, apparently. The entire profession has kind of shifted over to the MIT version, that it's a matter of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, and different drugs have an effect on that. So hopefully things will only get better.
Absolutely, boy. It has a bright future. And you know what? I don't worry. I'm just bringing it up because you brought it up. If I don't look back, I look forward. With that, I'll stand back and to you.
Okay, very good, Rich. Now on to the next. By now that we would have all the viral enemies of mankind recorded and placed in mankind's list of termination with extreme prejudice, but that isn't how nature works. A mosquito-borne virus discovered over a half century ago has been found in humans for the very first time, causing severe rash and fever in Florida teenager in 2016. But despite the recent reveal, it's likely the germ has been making people sick for quite some time. Named after the Florida area where it was discovered, the Keystone virus was found in mosquitoes as far back as 1964. Over the years, it's been spotted in various animal species living in humid, moist areas alongside the southern U.S., and there have been indirect evidence that it could infect humans as well. A 1972 study, for example, found that a fifth of the people in the Tampa Bay area who were tested had developed antibodies to the Keystone virus in their bodies. But the virus itself had never been found in people, and it had never been linked to illness. That changed in August 2016 when a 16-year-old boy visited an urgent care clinic in north central Florida. He had a nasty rash and a high fever. Because the Zika virus was then rapidly spreading across South America and had already been spotted in local Florida mosquitoes, the boy's lab samples were sent to the Emerging Pathogen Institute at the University of Florida. But he came up negative for Zika and other related viruses. Let me drop. It would take a long time before researchers at the university finally isolated the possible culprit, the Keystone virus. The boy's case was published in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases. The Keystone virus is a part of a group whose members typically infect cattle. In particular, it belongs to a variant first recorded in California. In animals as well as humans, these California viruses are known to cause brain inflammation and occasionally death, though most suffer no symptoms. Luckily, the boy who ultimately survived didn't seem to develop any of those symptoms. The discovery of Keystone in the boy doesn't definitely prove that it was making him sick, but given the lack of other suspects, it's the best guess that researchers have. And if that's the case, it almost certainly isn't the first time it struck, and it won't be the last. Keystone is thought to be mainly spread by the Aedes atlanticus mosquito, which also can spread the West Nile virus, the most common mosquito-borne disease in the U.S. I realize that all life has its little niches in nature, but do we really need mosquitoes? Let me drop for possible comments.
Yes.
Okay, on with the next. Life in space is hard on the human body. The lack of gravity's pull can quickly take its toll. Bone density declines, muscles deteriorate, and more. But compared to a fish, humans have it pretty easy. For several years, scientists working with the Japanese Space Agency studied the effects of life aboard the International Space Station for a small school of Madaka fish, also known as Japanese rice fish. Madaka are small freshwater fish native to Japan, and they are invaluable for space research. Not only are they easy to breed, but they are transparent, giving researchers a clear view at their bones and guts as they adjust to life in space. Let me drop. It turns out that the effects of microgravity on Makita aren't much different than our own. The effects just set in much faster. For humans, it takes at least 10 days for symptoms to start showing up, but according to a new study published in the journal Scientific Reports, the fish started to lose bone density almost immediately upon arriving in orbit. Since humans and Madaka grow their skeletons in similar ways, that gives scientists a good starting point to figure out how the process actually occurs. In order to get a closer look at how the fish's bodies reacted to life in space, the scientists genetically modified them so that two different types of cells would glow under different wavelengths of light. Let me drop. The first osteoclasts break down bone tissue as part of a process of repairing and maintaining any damage. The second, osteoblasts, create the matrix that bones form around. As soon as the fish made it to the ISS, they went into a special tank designed for microgravity and were observed from a remote lab at Tsukuba Space Center using the two different fluorescent lights as their bodies adjusted to their new environment. Because the fish reacted so quickly to their new living situation, the researchers were able to observe the effects of microgravity on their bodies almost in real time. Almost immediately, numbers of both types of cells increased noticeably when compared to an Earth control group, with certain genes going into action in ways not seen in normal gravity. Let me drop. While these findings are limited to this batch of lab-grown fish, it could eventually shed new light on the process that governs how human bodies adapt to space as well as typical human diseases like osteoporosis. For now, the researchers plan to continue their work with their next batch of fishy astronauts. Let me drop for possible comments.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
The scientists and doctors realized they had a problem with muscle and bone problems as far back as the early 1970s when Skylab 2 went up, the first crew that went up. They stayed for almost a month. And when they got back, they realized that their muscles and bones were, you know, they tested them right, you know, right after they came back, and also, you know, for weeks and months, maybe even years after that. But they realized they had a problem right away. So the next crew that went up, and there were three crews that went up to Skylab, from there on in and all the way, you know, to today's times, they've increased their calorie count because they were losing weight. The muscle loss is already there. They found out about that. And the bone problem. So what they did is they said they're going to have future astronauts exercise a lot and eat a lot more to try to compensate for that problem. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Paul. And that's useful advice for them. But unfortunately, it doesn't replace normal gravity. And as time goes on, doctors have been finding more stranger and stranger little things afflicting astronauts. I'm sure you're aware that a lot of astronauts return after prolonged microgravity exposure with visual disturbances. They have to start wearing glasses for the very first time. And who knows, as the time periods of people in microgravity and zero gravity extend further and further, what other aberrations happen. The trouble is we didn't evolve for a micro or a zero gravity environment. So there's a lot of little fine-tuning feedback mechanisms that are not going to quite work right. But, you know, that's the mission until we figure out how to artificial gravity or start to spin up rocket ships.
Yeah, okay, very good. And with the hydroponics, with the growing of the plants and all of that, anything to do with growing plants, animals, or people, it's definitely different than microgravity. Back to you, Rob.
It's one of the many things that the engineers and the scientists are really going to have to work very hard to figure out what kind of an environment to place human beings and animals where they won't have shortened lifespans and such. It's one of the more unsung aspects of research going on that continues to go on, and hopefully NASA will figure out a way. My guess is ultimately it's going to have to rely on some means of tricking your body into thinking there's a gravitational field somehow, whether that's rotating vis-a-vis 2001 A Space Odyssey or something yet undreamed of, I don't know. But I think we're going to have to fool our bodies. We're not going to just, you know, design ourselves to tolerate it. Genetic engineering isn't going to be developed that fast.
Oh, I concur. They had something called a Nautilus problem project that they were going to put on the space station in the beginning, the spinning modules they were going to have. And it would have had a really tough effect because the diameter really wasn't that big. I think it was only like, I don't know, 100 feet or something. So it wouldn't really be enough to be able to walk or stand. They thought maybe they could sleep in that environment and that would have helped them. It would have been, I think they said, one-third gravity or something. But that was all canceled. The expense was just too much. And like you said, it's either that or generic engineering. But for long-term flights, they're going to have serious problems. They're going to have to develop the wheel. That's it. You know, some kind of...